I'm Dan Roderick's, and this is Midday. Dan Bongino is a former Secret Service agent who was the Republican candidate for the U.S. Senate in Maryland in 2012. He lost to the incumbent, Democrat Ben Cardin, but received more than 670,000 votes in the general election, less than half Senator Cardin's total, but not bad for a newcomer. This year, Dan Bongino is again a candidate. He's running for the 6th District Congressional seat, held by freshman Democrat John Delaney, though he served in government for several years. Dan Bongino is a conservative, libertarian, and outspoken critic of the Affordable Care Act, Common Core, and other laws and policies he sees as intrusive. Another in our series of conversations with candidates after the news from NPR. Good afternoon once again and welcome to Midday. Dan Roderick's with you here on WYPR Baltimore, WYPF Frederick in Hagerstown, WYPO Ocean City, and the Eastern Shore, and streaming live online through WYPR.org. Thanks again for making Midday part of your day. In the second hour of the show today, David Zurawick will be joining us again, my colleague from the Baltimore Sun, the media critic at BaltimoreSun.com. Another edition of Midday on Media coming up in the second hour of today's show. In 2012, after 2 decades representing Maryland's 6th Congressional District, Republican Roscoe Bartlett was handily defeated in the election by wealthy financier John Delaney, a Democrat from Montgomery County. The victory came on the heels of the 2010 census when Democratic leaders in Annapolis redrew district lines to favor a Democratic candidate out there. Our guest today is hoping to return the 6th District back to Republican hands come election time. Dan Bongino is an international security consultant and a Severna Park resident. He's one of 2 Republican candidates vying for the job in the primary. The 6th District stretches from the Potomac to the West Virginia border and includes a large chunk of Montgomery County Democrats, a lot of them, and a large group of conservative-leaning Republicans in the Allegheny and Garrett counties. Before getting into politics, Dan Bongino served for 12 years as a U.S. Secret Service agent. During that time, he worked with the elite Presidential Protective Division during the administration of President George W. Bush and for a time during President Obama's first term. After he resigned from the Secret Service, Dan Bongino jumped into politics by mounting a campaign for the U.S. Senate against incumbent Democrat Ben Cardin in 2012. And it ended up being a 3-way general election. Dan Bongino had 670,000-plus votes in that. Of course, Senator Cardin won re-election with 1.4 million. It was a 3-way race, and the third candidate in that had some 400,000 votes. That was in 2012. This year's primaries are June 24th in Maryland. Some of Dan Bongino's platform issues include lowering tax rates for businesses, immigration reform, attention to border security, just a few of the things we'll talk about during the show today. We're also going to talk about his memoir. This is a rare opportunity that we have a candidate for office for an interview on Midday who's just published a book, Life Inside the Bubble, Why a Top-Ranked Secret Service Agent Walked Away from It All, by Dan Bongino, just published within the last month or so. Dan Bongino, nice to have you with us.
It's great to be here. Thanks so much.
I noticed that book went quickly to the New York Times ebook bestseller list.
Yeah.
It was like 12th or 13th?
Yeah, 13th.
In the first week that it
Lucky
was out.
Lucky 13, yeah, that's right.
And nice to have you on the show here.
Great to be here.
And this gives us an opportunity to do a little... not just because of the book, it's my custom when we have candidates on that we haven't met before to do a little biography. But I was curious about the book. Since you worked in the Secret Service, were you under any rules or restrictions in terms of writing about your experiences with the Secret Service? I know that's
yeah.
true for people in the CIA and the NSA.
Yeah, although I didn't consult with them on the book, the rules are pretty clear. Obviously, information that you would consider for official use only or, you know, God forbid, classified, you're not allowed to disclose that. And also, I took it to the next level, though. I was very careful to not disclose personal conversations or even things that may have seemed like they were cheap shots or behind the scenes. The book is not a tell-all. If that's what you're looking for, don't buy the book.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it's just my take on what the problems are in government, having been behind the scenes. So, but yeah, there are rules.
Let's start at the beginning. New York City, right? You grew up in New York.
New York, yeah. New York City.
And you went into the police academy Right after high school?
No. While I was in college, I went into this cadet program. It was like a paid internship. I spent 2 years over there as a cadet and then 2 years as a police officer afterwards.
What drew you to law enforcement to begin with?
Well, I always wanted to be an FBI agent. I wanted to be a profiler. And my father had stuck this Secret Service application in front of me. And, you know, it's funny how people change your life, these serendipitous moments. I had called the Secret Service after he gave me the pamphlet, and I spoke to this woman, Carol, who I think is still there. I said, "Hey, I'm Dan Bongino. I'd like to be a Secret Service agent." She said, "Well, what do you have? You have law enforcement experience? You're a lawyer?" I said, "No, I'd just like to be an agent." Well, when she got done laughing, she said, "You need some law enforcement experience. Call us back." And that's how I wound up in the NYPD.
How old were you then? In your 20s, early
20s? Yeah, 1920 or so, I guess, yeah.
So you were with NYPD for a couple of years?
Yeah.
And then you applied for the Secret Service?
I did. And then I moved quick. Took about 6 months. And it was a great sell. It was an attraction to the job after just my first interview was just magnetic. I had horse blinders on.
What appealed to you about it? I guess you assumed that Secret Service work would bring you close to the president, number one, right? Because that's what most people think of when they think of the Secret Service. I happen to think of counterfeit money.
Yeah, which is interesting. There's not many people
I had a relative in my family who had Secret Service agents come to her house once because of some counterfeiting that was going on upstairs that she didn't know about. Honest to God, Aunt Grace did not know about it. But there's a lot involved. You actually got involved in studying internet fraud?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yeah. Back then when I started with the Secret Service in 99, the internet obviously had been around, but it wasn't the footprint it had now. And little things like eBay had just started. And eBay was just, at that time, was just a home to fraudsters. You know, ironically, on 9/11, when the terrorist attack on 9/11, we were getting ready to arrest a guy who was selling diamonds on eBay who didn't have the diamonds. Back then, it was just so easy. So, yeah, we kind of grew with the internet, the Secret Service's footprint in electronic crimes. I grew with it. I liked fraud investigations. I liked credit card fraud. It was very cerebral. It's very complicated. Counterfeiting investigations are easy. It's kind of like investigating drugs. You know, you arrest a guy for drugs. You ask him where he bought it from. Same thing with counterfeit. They were easy. It didn't require a lot of a lot of brain work there. So I preferred the credit card fraud cases.
Why did the Secret Service get into that? I mean, that sounds like something that the FBI would tackle.
And I actually addressed that in my book. You bring up a good point. I mean, it's really, in my opinion, a waste of taxpayer dollars to have all these agencies fighting over the same piece of the pie. They got into it. That was actually their original mandate in 1865 when they were founded. They weren't founded to protect the president. They were founded to go after counterfeiters post-Civil War because it was rampant. Your money, there was almost a 50% chance it was fake. Secret Service squashed that. And then in 1910, after the McKinley, we then took over presidential
protection. After McKinley was assassinated.
Yeah, we took over presidential protection just because they were around the president. There wasn't any real reason we did it. It wasn't why we were founded. But, you're accurate with that.
And then you moved from electronic fraud to training others for that.
Yeah, that's how I wound up in Maryland. I was I do that MMA, mixed martial arts, a lot of what most people call UFC type stuff. But I'd always trained my whole life. It just was a good way for me to stay in shape. So my nose looks like this, been broken a couple times. And back then, it wasn't a big deal. People were boxing in the training center. And the boxing was causing a lot of problems because agents, Dan, you get a guy who knows how to box and a guy who doesn't, you're not learning it. You're learning how to get beat up. Mm. So I was grappling, doing this Brazilian jiu-jitsu. And long story short, they called me and said, "You want to come down and teach at the training center?" We didn't have a lot of guys who were doing it. That's how I wound up in Maryland. It's over in Prince George's County.
That was in Beltsville?
Beltsville, yeah. Over in Prince George's.
And when did you move into presidential or executive protection?
2005, right after. I went to DPD, the Dignitary Protection Division, for a little while, about a year, where I did some desk work, operations, some management type stuff, and then went over to the President's Detail.
How did you like that?
The President's Detail?
Any of it. The idea of protecting another human being.
I found it to be a noble, shockingly cerebral job. I think, and that bothers me sometimes even now when people talk about it. They go, you were a bodyguard, and I see, you really have no idea what you're talking about. I'm sorry. That insults the men and women who were there. I mean, the average education of a Secret Service agent is graduate school plus. These are very intelligent men and women. It is an extremely difficult job. I liked it. I enjoyed it, and I was attracted to the purity of the mission. You know, Dan, I mean, the mission's clear. It doesn't matter what the president, if he's a man, a woman, what the culture, religion, skin color, politics, it doesn't matter. You die first. That's it. Bottom line. If they attack the president, you go first, and that is it. And there's a purity to that mission that I think attracts a lot of people.
You were for a time with President Bush and then with President Obama.
That's right.
There's a photograph of you. It looks like you're holding the door to the presidential limousine for President Obama. I posted it on our Facebook page, too, because it's out there somewhere. Where was that photograph taken?
That was taken at the Philadelphia airport at a fundraiser for Joe Sestak, who was running against Pat Toomey. You
remember him,
in Pennsylvania. He lost, and Sestak was closing the gap, or may have been actually ahead of time, and President Obama was doing a fundraiser. And I, that day, I was the number one whip on the shift, meaning I was whipping the shift, what they'd say. I was kind of quasi-supervising the shift. That guy always has the door. Control of the door is actually a bigger deal than people. It's not holding the door as much as it is controlling access.
Would you say you had rapport with the president?
Yeah, he was a great guy, personally. Every time I say that, I get a lot of nasty grams from my side.
Well, I always wondered, what is the relation? The president knows the Secret Service agents by their first name. Does he call you by your first name? Does he refer to you as Mr. Bongino? How is that? Is there a formality to it? Or?
Some he knows by first name. Some he doesn't. He didn't know me by first name. I know he knew who I was because I was at that time I was the number one whip on my shift. Most of the supervisors, the special agent in charge, he definitely knows by first name, and most of the people underneath him. But it's a friendly relationship. But you got to be careful to not get too friendly.
I was going to say, is the president instructed not to chit chat too much with Secret Service? After all, they have a job to do, and chatting with the president can be a distraction.
Well, Dan, the president does what he wants. He's the president of the United States, and I'll tell you right now, this isn't the movies. No one tells the president what to do. The president wants to talk to you, he's going to talk to you. And I can tell you, when he got in office, he was very friendly. He wasn't used to being surrounded by agents all the time. And he'd come down, he'd grab you by the elbow. He asked me once where I had my suit made, which I thought was funny. I'm like, listen, you get a tailor tomorrow morning. You don't need to know where my suit was made. So he was very friendly when he got in. From what I've heard, he's become a little more detached now, but I don't think that's a function of President Obama. It's just a function of the presidency. President Bush, over time, became more detached as well. I mean, you're surrounded by people all the time.
So. Dan Bongino is our guest on Middays, a candidate for Congress in the 6th Congressional District in the primary in June on the Republican side. The book is called Life Inside the Bubble, but I'm interested in the subtitle, and so I'll start asking you some questions that get us there, and then we'll take a short break and continue. Why a top-ranked Secret Service agent walked away from it all? Why did you walk away from it all? It sounds like you had were you happy with your career?
I was. I loved it. I was honored to be a part of it. Listen, we've had some setbacks. I think the Columbia thing, unfortunately, still fresh in a lot of people's minds. But I can tell you there's no finer group of men or women in government. There are as fine, but there's no finer. They are unbelievably patriotic people who will do just about anything to make sure that continuity of government and our system of government continues. And it was an honor to be there. It really was. And that says a lot as to why I left. It wasn't anything the job did to me at all. They were really good people there.
Well, why did you leave? I mean, you must have been thinking about it. In 2012, you ran for the U.S. Senate in Maryland. You jumped right into politics here.
Yeah. Well, Dan, I've always been an idealist, and idealists typically die disappointed and broke. But, that's okay. I'm not going to be part of the problem. And it should say something to the listening audience, too, that I spent most of my time in a Republican administration. And, although I run as a Republican, I've been very clear in my criticism that you've been sold out, all of you. I think the wing of the Republican Party that's been corrupted is sold out to big business. I think the wing of the Democratic Party that's been corrupted is sold out to big business and big government and power. Both sides have sold you out. And being an idealist after a while, I just couldn't take it. I mean, it was not an easy decision. I left in a recession. I resigned. I didn't retire. So you can question my politics. That's fair game. You can question my political ideology. Fair game. But you question my character and why I left. You're walking down a dangerous road. It's my family and I have suffered financially for this decision, and we took it.
Well, have people questioned that? Because I'm certainly not. I'm just wondering why you did it.
No, I didn't want to allude to that on your end. No, there are people who do that. They've insinuated that I was fired from the Secret Service, which is absurd. You can Freedom of Information Act request it yourself. I left their highest ranked agent in my office. It's very rare to find a former colleague of mine that criticizes legitimately. There are a few out there, but they're usually people who worked on it in advance who didn't like how I handled my advances. I was AB, all business on those things. But, yeah, you get it once in a while. Politics is an ugly business.
You're saying your thoughts were forming about our society, about American government, and yeah. And you just said we've been sold out on both sides by big business, by government.
Yeah.
So all this was percolating inside you. You decided you had to run for office. There was nothing else, nothing short of that.
No. And I wanted to do something that listen, I knew, Dan, I'm not naive to the political consequences of my decision. I was a Secret Service agent through three presidential elections behind the scenes with the staffers and consultants on both sides who were paid millions of dollars. You know, I knew what I was doing was a huge risk. I mean, who in their right mind runs as a Republican in blue Maryland with no political experience? I wasn't running for dog catcher. I was running for U.S. Senate. But I knew I had a message. I knew I had a passion for change, for real change, not just these campaign signs. And I knew people would listen if I talked. And we did. We developed quite a following, considering how we didn't have a lot of assets, Dan.
I know that. That's why I pointed out the results of the election. I want to be specific about that before we go to the break here. Senator Cardin had 1.4 million votes, 55% of the vote in the general election of 2012. Dan Bongino, our guest here on Midday, ran against Ben Cardin as a Republican, had 674,000 votes, about 26%. But the other person I didn't use his name before, Rob Sobhany, right?
Sobhany.
We had him on the show that year. He spent a lot of money on television.
$8 million.
Was it $8 million? Yeah. He raised his profile significantly and ran as an independent and had another 420,000 votes in that general election. So it ended up being a three-way. Those were the results. I would say for your first time, 674,000 votes is pretty good. I mean, how did you feel about that?
Well, Dan, we were outspent 15 million to one.
Spent a million in 2012?
We spent $2 million over the primary, but in the general, it's actually probably less than a million that we spent in the general. So we were outspent $15 million to one. And, hey, a loss is a loss, folks. Please don't take this the wrong way. There's no silver medals in politics. But to give it some context, there's really no reason I should have even finished second, being that 40% of Maryland identifies themselves as independents. I should have finished third, but we had a tremendous grassroots operation. We had a lot of passion, a lot of great volunteers. And, you know, we finished second. We got smoked pretty bad, no silver medals. But, yeah, I'm proud of what we did. I actually got more votes than the former Republican Senate candidate in the last election. Was it Eric Wargatz, who got in a two-way race? So we feel like we did a decent job.
Dan Bongino is our guest in this hour of Midday. You can ask a question of the candidate. We'll hear more about his views when we get back after a short break. He's also published a memoir, Life Inside the Bubble, Why a Top-Ranked Secret Service Agent Walked Away from It All. 410-662-8780. The publisher of that book is WND Books. Dan Roderick's on Midday. Our Midday email address, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. And welcome back to Midday. Dan Roderick's here with Dan Bongino, Republican running for Maryland's 6th congressional seat in the June 24th primary. And also, Dan Bongino has been spending a fair amount of time in the media as well since leaving the Secret Service, and especially recently, right?
Yeah.
You told me you have a radio show on WMAL.
Weekends,
and then you fill in for Sean Hannity at times.
Yeah, Hannity, fill in for Mark Levin, do a lot of guest hosting at MAL, CBM, a lot of local networks, and sometimes I'll nationally do a lot of Fox and MSNBC and CNN on security, sometimes politics. But it's about once a week or so. We do some cable as well.
Mm-hmm. I've caught you on some of those shows. So let's talk some more about forming your ideas, your political ideology. So I've always asked people why they belong to one party over another. So I'll ask you, how long have you been a Republican and what makes you a Republican?
Yeah, it's tough because sometimes I've had equal amount of, let's say, beefs with the Republican Party as I have with the Democrats. Matter of fact, my Facebook post that got the largest footprint and reach was when I divorced the Republican Party. I had gotten so upset with some of the stances they'd taken. What makes me a Republican? You know, three simple ideas. I think you can spend your money better than the government. I think every parent has a right to send their kid to the school they want. They pay for it. And I think you have the right to control your own health care. It's simple as that. And if you believe those three bedrock things, then you right now cannot be a modern Democrat, not a JFK Democrat. JFK is actually one of my heroes. My mother was a JFK Democrat. That party is now dead. Those people are now called moderate Republicans. So that's why.
Okay, let's start with taxes and spending your own money. Where would you cut taxes? And, I mean, you would have to shrink the size of government, I guess. That would be the main purpose of it?
Well, it depends. When you study the economics of, not to get too wonkish, of dynamic.
Oh, we can get wonkish. It's public radio.
Let's do it. Let's do it. Well, you know, when you study dynamic scoring versus static scoring, meaning tax cuts do not equate to tax revenue losses. At a certain point, they do. Obviously, if I charge you zero tax on your income, you're not going to raise any money. But there's a sweet spot, Dan. There's a sweet spot on that curve where if I charge you too much, you're incentivized to hide your money. If I charge you too little, we don't raise enough to fund our military, court system in Maryland, the public education system, which is in its constitution. But there is a point. We are now way past that point. You know, I always give the example of the Reagan years, and you can check these numbers yourself, whether you believe them or not. When Reagan got into office, the top marginal tax rate was 70%. He cut it by the end of his term to 28%. And many of your listeners are probably saying, wow, we must have lost a ton of money. No, we doubled it. We were raising $500 billion in income taxes. The income tax revenue, this isn't adjusted for inflation, but it's not going to wipe it out either, was then $900 billion when he left. Because when people put money in their pockets, they spend it.
We also ran up huge deficits.
No question. You are correct. A lot of, I love Reagan, but a lot of Reagan apologists will say, they'll say, nah, that's not true. It is true. Reagan did spend a lot of money. You know, and let's be fair. Tip O'Neill was part of that as well. I mean, Reagan did not want to run up as high a deficit as he did, but there was a lot of defense spending. And yes, there were deficits. There's no question about that. So,
well, where do you cut then? I guess that's what I want to know. Because I've heard many Republicans, conservatives say taxes are too high. You can always say taxes are too high. And then I ask the question, okay, where are we, you know, misspending our money? Where in your view is it?
Well, there's a whole chapter in the book on, I mean, this is just a small exam. We can go on for days about even in the federal law enforcement apparatus, the duplication of duties and responsibilities, Dan, is absurd. You would not impact our counterterror law enforcement abilities at all by wiping out probably half of the agencies, not the people within the agencies, and consolidating them into one unified effort. You know, I asked the listeners, why do we have an FBI, a DEA, an ATF, NCIS? I mean, the list goes on. Why? I mean, no one can give you a real practical answer. I mean, the Secret Service does fraud investigations, so you're paying me $150,000 a year to do it. I got news for you. You're also paying an FBI agent to do the exact same thing.
Mm-hmm.
If we had one law enforcement operation, one intelligence operation, and one internal affairs type operation, and streamline them and kept the personnel, you'd save, Dan, hundreds of billions of dollars over a 10-year cycle.
Homeland Security is now the third largest agency of government. I meant to ask you, where were you on 9/11, and what's been your reaction over the years to the growth of Homeland Security, the war on terror, the Patriot Act, all of that?
Now, the Patriot Act was an abomination.
The Patriot Act was an abomination.
Oh, no. I mean, listen, no serious liberty-loving individual on I. This is the one irony. You know, our politics may be different, but this is the one area where people of the libertarian persuasion like myself and the Occupy Wall Street crowd completely agree. Section 215 of the Patriot Act, which has been used in the NSA as a constitutional bedrock for it, is a total violation of your liberties, no question in my mind. Where was I in 9/11? I was in New York getting ready to arrest a guy on that eBay fraud. And I remember Tommy Hunter, special agent, he's in the book. He ran in the office and said, I was just on the phone with the New York office and a bomb went off. And of course, it wasn't a bomb. It was planes. But we went and rushed to the TV and The View was on in my boss's office. And we thought, no way, a bomb went off The View. And all of a sudden, it said breaking news.
Yeah.
And we watched that second plane come in.
You think we overdid it with Homeland Security? Because, you know, at the time, it seemed like what everybody wanted to do. And we actually launched a couple of wars, too.
Yeah.
So today, when you are among your fellow Republicans or even libertarians and talk as you just did, speak as you just did about the Patriot Act, what's the reaction? People agree with you? They think we went too far with this?
Sometimes they don't. I've got a lot of I get positive and negative feedback from both sides of the aisle. But the one issue I find I get the most negative feedback from some, I don't know what to call, moderate Republican. I mean, everybody's got a title these days, is on foreign wars and the Patriot Act. Listen, the war in Iraq, these kids are dead, Dan. I mean, I have an 18-year-old. I think he was 18, a kid in my neighborhood. He was. I say was because he's no longer there. There's a gazebo built in my neighborhood to the memory of this kid who's now dead. He will never take another breath died in Iraq. For what? We just gave up Anbar. Fallujah is a mess. You know, we're going to send, I have two daughters. I'm telling you right now, I'm not sending my kids to die on foreign soil for a war that the people on that foreign soil are not even willing to fight themselves. Some, not all. So
that, how many Americans stood by as the president launched this war, President Bush?
A lot. No question. And on both sides. This was not voted on unilaterally by Republicans. And that's what I don't like playing a politics game. And a lot of people absolve a lot of the Democrats that if I'm going to go.
No, I don't.
Yeah, I know you. I've yeah. read your stuff. Mm. But a lot of Republicans are willing to forgive a Republican when they do it. And Democrats, a Democrat. Not me. I have never defended these wars. For 3 years now, I've been speaking out against them.
So do you think our military is too large in this world we live in today? Because I wanted to ask you about a couple of things. You know, we had this report about atrocities in North Korea. We've got this horrendous, atrocious civil war underway in Syria. We're not doing much about that, you know. President supported eradication of the chemical weapons over there, but we haven't really done very much. We're not the America we used to be, which would consider intervening in situations like this. Now you have atrocities reported in North Korea. And I just wonder, what's your perspective on the U.S., our role in the world in conflicts like that going forward?
Well, I have I try to play a middle ground, not for the political ramifications, but for the philosophical ones. I'm definitely not an interventionist by any measure. But I do think we need to set, you know how the Newt Gingrich had these 12 principles they were going to run on this contract with America. Mm-hmm. I think we need to reset and have a contract with American citizens on when we are going to get involved internationally. I think what we've done is, you know, we sell horror stories to the American people, which are legitimately tragic. That North Korean report, you can't read that and not get a tear in your eye or in your soul. It's awful. The question is, will American involvement make it better or worse? And are you, the listener, are you willing to sacrifice your kid to change it? It's very easy for me as a potential congressman to go out and say, hey, Dan, I'm going to send your kid. Then when it comes to, hey, you're going to send yours? Oh, no, not mine. I was talking about your kid. That's totally that we cannot.
Well, we're
going to
send the ones
problems.
That have volunteered because we don't have a draft.
Right. And I'm not willing to do that either unless I think there is a clear metric. In other words, I think the Iran obtaining a nuclear weapon is going to be very dangerous. I think we have to have a strategic plan. But on other issues in Syria, I think we're only going to make the problem worse if we get involved.
410-662-8780. I'd like to get our listeners involved in this conversation with Dan Bongino, a candidate for Congress in the Republican primary June 24th. He's running in the 6th congressional seat. Let's take a couple of calls, Dan, then we'll go back. I have some more questions for you. Kevin in Lutherville, thank you for calling Midday. Hi.
Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for the conversation. The conversation has taken so many directions. I'm not really sure that I want to ask the question that I called in, but I will. I specifically called in about K Street and what Dan's thoughts were about K Street, its influence on our federal government, and whether or not we should be able to restrict it, abolish it, or keep it in place.
He's talking about the special interests of lobbyists.
Yeah, that's a great question, Kevin. Listen, it's a mess. Lobbyists, here's how the system works, Kevin. And trust me when I tell you, this is a bipartisan problem. I've seen it. I've worked in two administrations, one in R, one in D. Lobbyists come in. They lobby for their, let's say they make, Dan's got a brown sport jacket on today. Let's say you're Mr. Brown Sport Jacket. You own a company that makes those sport jackets. So what you do is you then come in and you lobby for your tax break for your company, which puts you at an advantage over other companies because your tax bill is lesser. You have more capital to spend and invest in your company. What does the politician get? He gets from your PAC, he gets a nice big fat donation, usually about $10,000. He then puts the legislation out, gives you that break in the tax code, and your company puts other companies out of business because your costs are less. It's one big scam, but I'll tell you, it's not just K Street, it's internal lobbying too, and I write about it in my book. There are people in the federal government right now, regulatory capture, they call it in a lot of these respects, who are only working for the federal government to develop contacts, to go work in the private industry later on, to use those contacts to give their company an advantage. It's not just K Street. That's a big part of the problem, but not the only part.
Yeah, the New York Times had a story about how many of them are just ignoring the rules about that, too, and the revolving door spins. Yeah. Well, why do you want to be a part of this? So let's say you ran for the Senate. Yeah. Now, if you wanted to run for Congress, wouldn't you run into this in Washington?
Yeah, but I do because I think I don't say this out of any sense of self-inflated worth. I get I'd be one of 435, but that doesn't mean that your voice is one of 435. We've developed a pretty good following because we've been willing to go after both parties. And Dan, I think I have enough of a voice and a platform right now to call truth to power, bring truth to power.
But what are you going to do about money, say? You need money to run for Congress, as you needed money to run for the Senate. Yeah. You didn't have enough.
So what
are you going to do about that?
Well, that luckily hasn't been a problem. I actually out-fundraised my opponent last quarter, who's worth $250 million.
In the primary?
Your
opponent would be in the general if you were to win the primary.
Yeah, I out-fundraised the sitting congressman by $20,000.
Are you doing something like limiting the size of donations or anything like that?
Well, they're limited by federal law.
Personally, you're saying, nothing over $100. I'm not saying you should.
Yeah.
I'm just, because given what you just said about the influence of, lobbyists on Congress, we have the Citizens United ruling.
Sure.
A lot of people are concerned that, Congress has just been completely co-opted by those who have the dough to spend on Congress.
Yeah, fair enough. I don't take PAC money from issues I don't already have a philosophical alignment with. In other words, I don't want to say what, but I had a supporter who suggested I change a position because it would appeal to certain PACs. And, I said, why would you even bring that up? It's not even an option. I didn't leave D.C., to get away from these idiots, to go become one of them, I guess is what I'm saying.
Do you think public financing is a bad idea?
No, I don't. I actually, when I was looking at some other races, had looked into it. I think it's a good idea, but I just think it's inadequate. I mean, it's been a big issue in the Maryland governor's race. But Dan, you're going to run on $2.5 million while, the Democrats in the state get to raise $20 million. I mean, mm-hmm. It should be a dollar for dollar match. I don't think it's a bad idea, but I think the system right now is definitely broken.
What about the Citizens United ruling? Does that concern you? It concerns a lot of our listeners here who have called in over time and said that they think that's sort of the final straw. They had the last big push of influence by corporate America on Congress that's already completely co-opted.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's easy to – the Citizens United has been used by some on the left as a talking point. But the reality is if it was implemented fairly – Dan, I have no problem with unions. I grew up in a union family. My brother's a union electrician. My father was a union plumber. This is not an attack on unions. So everybody take off the ideological hat. But we have to be honest and fair, and we talk about this. Unions have had an undue influence in politics for years. When Citizens United, which just gave corporations the ability not to donate to candidates, I am not allowed to take corporate money no matter what, but gave them the ability to go up on the air and just free speech rights, say, hey, we support this issue, which Dan Bongino happens to support. Everybody went nuts. But everybody has to remember, unions, the Sierra Club, they'd been doing that for years.
Did you want to compare them to, say, ExxonMobil, the oil lobby?
Dan,
everybody. What else?
The
healthcare industry, the insurance industry.
The largest spenders are unions. And everybody always goes after Coke, the Koch brothers. The bottom line is, you know where they rank?
Dan. Unions are the largest spenders on campaign contributions.
You have Sierra. You had C3s and C4s for years. I'm not saying, listen, I just made the whole case that undue influence is a problem. I'm not saying that the case was a good, I'm just saying that we have to implement these processes fairly. Look at the new IRS ruling. It exempts unions, but it goes after whatever, the Tea Party patriots. They're not going to be allowed to hand out a pamphlet anymore. That's not fair. I'm just asking for a fair system.
410-662-8780 is the phone number for midday. We're going to take a short break and come back and continue our conversation with Dan Bongino. You can ask a question. You can also submit one by email, midday@wypr.org. We'll be right back. Another Candidates Hour here on Midday. Dan Bongino is with us. He's a Republican running in the 6th congressional district race, the primary in June this year. They, of course, moved the Maryland primary up from September to June. June 24th it is. And Dan Bongino's book is out, Life Inside the Bubble, Why a Top-Ranked Secret Service Agent Walked Away from It All. The publisher is WND Books. Another question from one of our listeners. This is Emmanuel in Baltimore. Emmanuel, you're on Midday with Dan Bongino.
Yes, how are you doing, Dan?
Okay.
Thanks for taking my call. Yeah, I had a question about how he might reinstall the pillar to the middle class, which I think everybody thinks it was manufacturing. I mean, this is a big tax base there lost because of all the offshoring and stuff. And the one other thing was, I guess I call it the corporate anaconda that surrounds inside the Beltway there. What is his thoughts on that?
Yeah. First of all, maybe restoring the middle class a little bit on that. The second part of that, I think I understood what he meant about the corporate anaconda.
Sure. Yeah. I think we all strangling. I get it. Listen, Emmanuel, the middle class, and I don't like when some Republicans run away from this topic. It has been disappearing. There's no question about that. But it's due to a very specific set of policies that some Republicans and many Democrats have all furthered. It's a bipartisan destruction that's happened for decades. It's got to do with an unnecessarily high corporate tax in the country, a lot to do with compliance costs for companies. It's got a lot to do with education disparities in an ideas economy and the growth of the finance industry due to monetary uncertainty at the expense of those costs, which would be reinserted back in the economy. Long story short is those are policies that have been unfortunately bipartisan. There is a very simple and easy path forward to regrow a prosperous middle class, but unfortunately, it requires people to get away from the talking points, which politicians of both sides are uncomfortable with. Anytime you mention a corporate tax, the left goes crazy. They say, what do you mean? We're not going to tax business? That's not what I said. What I said is, do you have to tax them? You have to be the gold medal of taxation in the entire world? Companies aren't stupid, Dan.
Huge corporations that pay no corporate taxes in the United States.
That pay a lot.
But what about profits? I need to ask you that. The loss of manufacturing jobs. Emmanuel asked specifically like that.
Yeah.
I mean, that has been a long, slow decline in the United States, a seismic change in our society that you don't have people who can just come out of high school, go find a decent, maybe union job in manufacturing anymore. And there's been a big loss there. It's a 30 or 40 year, 50 year process.
Right.
Lots of jobs that went overseas. How do you bring them back? I mean, can you bring them back?
Yes, you can. You have to ask yourself, why would a company that sells the majority of their products within the United States choose to offshore and outsource a factory to another country to then ship it back over an ocean to bring it back here to sell it again, to deal with all those international regulations? They do it because the costs imposed on American companies within the United States are unnecessarily high. I'll give you an example, a mathematical example for those that question this. Our corporate tax rate is now the highest in the industrialized world, 35%. You bring up an accurate point, though. Some pay no tax at all. But there's a reason for that. The reason is they just don't locate here. They move offshore. So I ask you this. Do you want the jobs or not? The effective corporate tax rate in the United States is about 17%. That's about what companies pay on average. Some pay none. Some pay the 35% load. So when common sense talk, why can't both parties come together and say, well, if the effective rate's 17%, why don't we just make the rate 17% and have the companies bring their businesses back here? No one wants to say that because both sides have to go after each other with these slings and arrows.
Back to our question, our discussion earlier about the size of government and the government's role. You're such an outspoken critic of Obamacare, of the Affordable Care Act.
Yeah.
Why?
Because it's the most uncompassionate, devastating piece of legislation forced down America's throat in my lifetime and potentially past my lifetime. Dan, anyone listening who thinks Obamacare is about health care, you didn't see what I saw. It was never about health care. It was about health care control. And I can tell you right now, they could have given every single uninsured person in America, every one of them, a cash voucher to go buy Cadillac insurance plans from the private market and would have been cheaper and more effective than this abomination they put out there now. That is, I had my insurance policy canceled. It was only saved when Obama reversed his decision on Obamacare. So no one's going to tell me it hasn't personally affected me because it has. And secondly, it has done nothing to meet its own metrics.
Yeah, on the point about it being canceled, the idea was that you were underinsured, that your policy wasn't good enough.
How does he know that?
Well, it didn't meet the standards of the law. Okay, let's just say that's the reason why.
Right.
Then the idea was to go into the exchange, into the marketplace, and buy a better policy. And for some people, get subsidies for that.
Yeah.
So where's the lack of compassion in that idea?
Well, at what cost? I mean, Dan, if you don't view the world through the lens of reality and you view it through the lens of some utopian fantasy that doesn't exist, you tend to see things as a cost, a benefit without a cost. In other words, I can speed to work every day. I'd get there quicker. But if I don't look at it through the cost lens, too, I could get arrested. I could kill someone. I could get a speeding ticket. I mean, that's not
the way
you're
saying Obamacare is just going to cost too much. The country
cost too much. And you said something I absolutely wholeheartedly challenge you on and disagree with. How do you tell me about my insurance plan?
I don't know about
okay,
it.
Okay, all right, wait, hold
you
on.
You said
hold
it
on,
was canceled,
stop,
and I'm just pointing out all those people who, you know, where Obama said, if you like your policy, you can keep it. I agree.
Right.
That was wrong.
It was a lie.
He shouldn't have said that. Right. Yeah. But the reason he stated that is because people, not only were people uninsured, people were underinsured.
Well, Dan, you just told me you don't know about my insurance plan. So how do you know I was underinsured?
I don't know specifically
okay.
your
wait,
plan.
Wait, hold on. Can I ask you this?
But though? I would assume that the reason it was canceled is because of the law.
Well, you're assuming, but you don't know. That's the point.
So you're saying I don't want to argue with you because I didn't see your policy. But you're saying your policy was fine. You were happy with it.
Well, fine. It was terrific. Matter of fact, it was so good when I left the federal government. When I resigned, I couldn't take the plan with me. I resigned. I didn't retire. I paid out of my own pocket
to keep it.
The same plan.
So what was wrong with it? Did you explore and find out why it was being canceled?
Well, no, it didn't meet probably maternity coverage, but my wife and I aren't having any more kids. My wife has lupus. I probably shouldn't say that, but I already did. She has a doctor she uses in Washington, D.C., we're hearing now our premiums are going to go up $200, our deductible tripled, she may potentially lose her doctor. And then people tell me things like you said, well, it's for a better plan, but you don't know anything about my plan. And when liberals call in, when I host the radio station, what I consider far left liberals, not moderates now, they say to me, well, President Obama wanted your plan to be better. And I go, well, tell me about my plan. They say, well, I don't know anything about your plan. I said, so let me get this straight.
Yeah, we're at a disadvantage, Dan. I don't know about your plan specifically. I know what the idea was, what is built into the law.
Yeah, but doesn't
if you were underinsured as well, because you would still cost the rest of us if you were underinsured.
Yeah,
not
but
saying
you don't
you,
know that.
Well.
But so I give everybody an out when they call. I say, tell me just about my plan. And they say, I don't know. I say, so let me get this straight. You don't know anything about my plan. But you want to cancel 7 million plans you know nothing about either.
So you don't buy into this idea of the keeping insurance in the private marketplace and having people up the quality of their coverage or have coverage.
Yes, voluntarily.
For millions of people who didn't have any coverage.
Yeah, but you're assuming that it's upping the quality of the coverage. If my wife loses her doctor and I have to pay for something I don't want, how is that better for me? Dan, you know, this is a world of cost benefit. If you send me into a supermarket and force me to buy broccoli, I'm not going to eat and throw out. And you say, well, it's going to be healthier. And then I don't buy bread and starve to death. You can say, oh, we tried to make them healthier.
I heard Justice Scalia mentioned the broccoli. Yeah. And the Supreme Court said it's, you know, it's cool. It's a constitutional law.
Yeah,
but I want to ask you this. I have always this trouble with Republicans who complain about the Affordable Care Act.
Right.
And obviously, I think there's lots of flaws with it myself. But
sure.
Where were you 2009, 2008, when the Republicans were nowhere on health insurance, health insurance in the United States?
These
complaints now about how the exchange doesn't work, and I'm with you kind of on that.
Yeah.
That is a mess up there. But the principle that we should be expanding health care in the United States to get other people covered, to try to get control of costs.
Sure.
Where were Republicans?
Fair. That is an absolutely fair criticism. We have been hesitant. You can't just be the no party. Hey, this stinks. What's your solution? No, nothing, but that stinks. There are ideas out there now, though. I was very vocal. I mean, 2009, I was working for the Secret Service, so because of the Hatch Act, I couldn't be. But when I left, I was very vocal that I felt that we should have a means-tested benefit to those in the social safety net that need it, where they can buy a private sector plan just like rich folks, government employees, and everyone else, that means-tested benefit based on income, where they would choose the plan, not some government top-down manage, go to the government clinic plan. It was a very simple option. It was actually, I know people don't want to hear this, and I'm not a huge fan of some of his politics lately, but Paul Ryan put that idea out there too and was pilloried for it. So you can't have a means-tested benefit. We got to have these people in a government-managed plan. Well, why? They can't manage it themselves? I don't understand.
Well, there are choices in it. Did you go on the marketplace to see what your choices were?
No, because President Obama revoked that Obamacare
provision. Have another year.
So I have another year. Yeah, exactly.
All right, let's get off that and ask a couple of our listeners for questions for Dan Bongino. This is Greg on the Eastern Shore. We'll go to him next. Oh, Greg's gone. I'm sorry. He wanted to ask you about global warming. Well, do you believe it's happening? Do you believe climate change is happening? I'll ask for him.
Yeah, climate changes all the time. Yeah, we call it weather.
No, in a way that man has caused climate change, that we need to do something about this because of problems up ahead. I mean, are you concerned about that?
Of course. I mean, I moved to Maryland because, you know, the bay, the largest estuary in the world, the Catoctin Mountains. I mean, listen, saying that Republicans are anti-environment, you didn't say that, I want to be clear, but some people do, is absurd. It's
ridiculous. Still hear people say that they don't buy the science on climate change, that it's man-made, that's man-caused, It's getting worse. It's going to lead to extreme weather, and it's going to make life here on the planet harder to live in the long run for our kids.
Here's the bottom line on the issue of the environment, because it's a larger picture. Everybody can say the science is settled. People thought that the sun revolved around the moon once, and the science was settled on that, too. The bottom line is there are some very sensible, common-sense people who have said that, yes, the environment should be our number one priority. We live here. It's not an option, too. But secondly, spending money on a program that we cannot even figure out, they can't. The hockey stick graph has been largely dismantled. You can read their own emails. They don't understand it fully yet. Here's my point on this. It is the redistribution going on has caused more environmental disasters in human history than any free market system ever has for the environment.
The redistribution.
Yeah, when you look at socialist economies, right? Look at the greatest environmental disasters in world history. Chernobyl, Pemex, the Yangtze River, the Aral Sea. These were in redistribution economies, Dan, where people did not have an interest, a market interest in maintaining their environment. My point in this is we have to start figuring out ways to get people to be stakeholders in the health of the bay, in the health of our forests. And right now we don't have that. It's a government top-down managed system. They want carbon taxes and things like that, and it's only going to degrade our environment further.
You don't think the government has a role in regulating, say, businesses and even communities that pollute?
Oh, no, I absolutely do. I mean, matter of fact, that's why with the corporate tax.
Well, what's wrong with top managed? I mean, who's going to do that if government doesn't do that?
Dan, listen, did you ever notice in your neighborhood that most lawns, 90% of them are nicely manicured and kept green most of the time, and then you go to the park in the neighborhood and the lawn's full of weeds? Well, why is that? It's because it's called the tragedy of the commons. When everybody owns something vis-a-vis the government, nobody owns it. Why do you think government-owned land is typically some of the most mismanaged? What I'm saying is,
trying to get your philosophy on that. Then, when it comes to the Chesapeake Bay, for instance, then are we not all invested in that?
Yeah, and it's no cleaner. I mean, we're spending $8,000 per citizen to remove a pound of nitrogen from the bay, Dan. You know, a stray cat puts 3 pounds into the bay. A stray cat. So, as my friend Richard always brings up in Carroll County, it would be cheaper, and this is not a joke, it would be cheaper to build a Ritz-Carlton hotel for stray cats to keep them from polluting the bay than it would be now to actually clean the bay up. The bay is no cleaner. The point is, if we had a market
Carroll
interest.
Well, Carroll County certainly isn't helping with that. I mean, we have a law passed in Maryland that establishes a stormwater fee, asking local jurisdictions, 10 of them, to establish stormwater remediation programs by setting a fee, and Carroll County is resisting that.
No, well, because we're looking at market.
So, okay.
Yeah.
Well,
what about a market approach? I mean, why does it always have to be a stick? Why not a carrot? In other words, why not say to a business or a home, if you put rain barrels up, if you put stormwater management ponds, if you can do something with your roof to control, if you can make your parking lot a terrascape instead of a hard concrete to prevent runoff, we'll give you a tax break worth this amount.
Well,
so your
they are doing that, but you need to raise the revenue before you give
Dan,
the break.
But you're not raising revenue, because what's happening, like the business owner I spoke to in Anne Arundel County 2 years ago has a flat roof over in BWI, the business park. He's closing his business. He's now leaving because he doesn't have the money. So the point is, you're not raising revenue. You're losing revenue because companies are leaving. All of these taxes sound great in theory. The bottom line is they raise no money at all to actually clean the bay. You give people a market interest to keep the bay clean. Personal, a Dan Roderick's market interest. You will get a tax break on your property tax if you install rain barrels, stormwater ponds.
I intend to do that. But also, I'm paying my Baltimore City stormwater fee in Baltimore City, because there are other programs in place, not just my rain barrel, that need to be paid for.
Right, but the taxes we instituted even in the past, not these new ones that are going to drive more businesses out of state, we had a flush tax. What's that done? Has anybody even looked at
flush
the numbers?
Flush tax has upgraded the wastewater treatment plants
right,
around
Dan,
the state.
Right, Dan, and is the bay any cleaner? No, well, that's the point.
I don't know what your measure of that is. Boy, we have
nitrogen load.
I think you have to come back. I have so many other issues and phone calls
like
for you here.
Dude.
Boy, that hour went by fast.
Yeah, it did. But...
Well, so I will invite you back another time.
I appreciate it.
Because I enjoyed the conversation.
You're my favorite liberal.
Thank you very much.
You do good work.
Dan Bongino has been our guest in this hour of midday. He's a candidate in the June primary on the Republican side for the 6th congressional seat. He also has published a memoir. It's called Life Inside the Bubble: Why a Top-Ranked Secret Service Agent Walked Away from It All, published by WND Books. Thank you, Dan.
Very well.
And please enjoy lunch today provided by Breathe Bookstore Cafe, serving inspired vegetarian, vegan, gluten-free savories. I know you're going to like this. Sweets and more. They also have sweets, vegan sweets. Open 7 days a week at 810 West 36th Street. We thank Breathe Books for providing lunch for our guests today. They're over in Hamden. Stay tuned for the news, and we'll see you for midday on Media.